This is the Brian Callen Show. All right, everybody. This is the Brian Callen Show. I don't know why I laugh every time I say that, because I couldn't come up with a better name. It's the Brian Callen Show.
For fuck's sake, man.
For fuck's sake.
Am I allowed to curse
you
on this?
You sure are. That's John. That's Johnny Bloodclot Joseph. For those of you who don't know, I'm doing a series on, I'm in New York shooting this movie with Michael Rapaport and John Stamos. Calm down, everybody. Calm down. It comes out soon. And I'm basically going to do, I'm finding the most colorful New Yorkers, the true New Yorkers that I know, and I'm going to do basically five different points of view on New York. And John, you're the first guy. Now, I'm going to give you a little history on John Bloodclot. Anybody in New York who lives in New York, who's a real New Yorker, knows who John Bloodclot is. John was the lead singer of a band called the Cro-Mags.
Still am.
You still are. And in fact, I would say, John, that, and you were one of the original tough guys. I mean, you were, when I knew you when you were younger, you were pretty much feared on the Lower East Side. That's, I saw that with my own eyes. And I remember back in the East Village when it was so dangerous, you lived like near Ludlow Street. Now it's the chicest part of the city, and you used to have to meet me on Houston to walk me down to your apartment so I didn't get jumped.
Well, it was actually called, the East Village is kind of the name it took on later, but we called it the LES, Alphabet City.
LES meaning Lower
East
Side.
Lower East Side, yeah.
Yeah, like, and that was your, you saw some crazy
oh, dude,
shit.
I mean, when I was on the streets at 14 and 15 coming down here, you know, I ran away from St. John's Home for Boys.
So tell us a little bit about how you grew up. I know you've written about it in your book.
My father was a maniac Irish prize fighter, welterweight in the city, and, you know, just was real fucked up to my mom, beat her up. She was on pills. The state took us away.
So it's just kind of like a nice Greenwich. Kind
yeah,
of
you know, with the maids and the servants and the whole nine yards. But so we were basically raised in really bad foster homes. One of them was closed down by the state, and then St. John's Home for Boys in Rockaway. And then went on to the streets and proceeded to rack up criminal charges and ended up going upstate for 18 months. We were...
What'd they call you in jail? Didn't you have a nickname?
Mighty Whitey in Spofford.
They called you Mighty
Whitey? Yeah, because, you know, it was the first time when I went to Spofford, I was the only white kid in the entire place, and it was the place everybody feared going to. Spofford's closed now, but, you know, that was the one thing they held over you was, you know, if you keep fucking up, you're going to go to Spofford. And nobody wanted to go to Spofford, especially not a white kid. So when I got there, this black dude in reception, when you first indoctrination, when you get there, you know, everyone's in the room. They strip search you the whole nine. And then dude is like, you're going to be my Maytag. I didn't even know what the fuck a Maytag was, but I was like, nah, fuck that. You're going to be my Maytag. So everybody starts laughing. Like, you
well,
know
the thing
what you-
to interrupt you, because I know you, and you were never somebody to take any shit from anybody. You have a look in your eye. I mean, you're mm-hmm. always been a strong, strong, like, rough dude. You're not a big guy, but you can look at you, and you can tell that if somebody is going to come at you, you're going to meet them halfway. Were you always that way?
I mean, I had to be just because I was on the streets. And, I mean, you know, New York 1977 was the highest crime rate, murder rate in the entire nation. And you know, I was a kid on the street. So if some big dude came up on me, I had to put a 2x4 or a pipe across their face or a bottle. I would. It wasn't I was trying to be a tough guy. I was just trying to survive.
I was with you a couple times where, you know, we almost got in fights. And I mean, I remember how quickly you didn't back down, just how quickly you met that challenge. I remember those dudes who were saying they were these guys down on, we were on Avenue A, I remember, and these guys were like, yo, why don't you step over here into the fucking alleyway? Let's go. And you're like, why don't you step right here? But you knew they had a gun. I remember you said, I think those guys have got a gun. They're trying to get me in there to shoot me. And I didn't know that. I didn't even realize. I was like, well, we can fight them.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, let's go in there and fight them, you know? They didn't look that tough. You're like, nah, bro, well, you don't know anything about this.
It was a different world to New York, because the thing was, like, people would actually fight. Now people pop shit and then, you know, they get fucked up and they go to the cops. It's like, you know, I mean, I had two cases like that where somebody started a fight with me and it was like I ended up fucking them up. And then, you know, most of the time, like the real bad dudes I know, like, I you know, yeah. I mean, the blues, and even, I mean, even yourself, you don't ever talk about it, but I always tell people, I'm like, that dude's a badass.
But, I'm not a badass. Nah, dude, I'm not a badass, but I like you saying, I like the way you say it. But let me ask you this now. Now, tell me. So you got to Spofford, and you said, "Now you're going to be my Maytag," and they started laughing.
So then when we got to the wing, you know, the cops, when I went up to Spofford, by the way, they were two Irish cops, and they were like, you know, they told me straight up, and I hate to use the N word or whatever, but I'm going to tell you exactly word for word verbatim what they said to me. They said the first nigga or spick that fucks with you in Spofford, you better take him out, because the last kid, white kid that we brought up there, they took out of there on a stretcher.
Wow.
So
you were scared.
I was scared. I mean, I was on scared straight. My cottage, Elm Cottage, when I actually finally got upstate, they took us to Rawway and all that, to, you know, scared straight. But I mean, when you go to Spofford, you're the only white dude. And
yeah, you came out. I remember you came out. I've heard you. You came out very sympathetic to black people.
I was raised with black people my whole life, and I never understood, you know, like, you know what I'm saying? We were, you know, in the same areas together.
Yeah, like, so they were all your friends.
And I grew up listening to black music. I used to say I wish I was black, you know. Like, just because of the fact, I mean, come on, man. I'm in Deer Park or Garden City, and the coolest people were the black people. They would just had the clothes down, everything, like the music.
Right.
You know, so anyway, I just didn't really get it. But in Spofford, it was a real eye-opener. And then I put a he fucked with me, and I put a chair across his head and then knocked his friend's tooth out. So, like, after that, nobody messed with me. But it ain't all about fighting. You know, it's a lot of those kids had problems too, like myself. You know,
of course.
It was like, you know, at night when the what I said in my book, Evolution of a Cro-Magnon, everybody was a tough guy until they went in their cells at night, and then you heard the kids crying because they were just kids that had fucked up existences, like, you know, like myself. So, you know, you had to put this tough guy image on so that you didn't.
But see, what I've always loved about you, and one of the reasons that I've always considered you somebody, I've always respected you. We've always been friends, but more importantly, I've always kind of respected you. And always, one of the things I love about you is you're such a unique person. And one of the things that I remember that always amazed me about you is that despite all the shit you went through, despite your total lack of guidance, you came out of it an incredibly positive, well-rounded, kind, and loving person. And I think it's because you found religion, but I think it's more than that.
Well, I say spirituality. I never say religion, because to me, religion is dogma. It's what's fucking up the, you know, a lot
so
of these.
So just define to me what spirituality is to you. Is it the notion
it's getting
that
in touch with who you really are? You know, I mean, the process I chose to go down the road is bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, and it's all about helping your fellow man and helping people and developing devotion to the supreme personality of Godhead. I mean, yoga means to link with the supreme. So,
do you remember when you decided to do that? What was it that? Because I know you went through a drug phase.
Yeah,
I
was heavily addicted to drugs even as a kid. I was just a garbage pail of just doing everything, and then even had the crack thing where they just were like, I mean, I was strong arm robbing like the worst crack. Crazy crack dealers with guns and just
that's
all
how you
kinds.
I know that I heard that about
no
you.
No
it's
like,
why it's why
it,
people
yeah.
were afraid of you.
I was
remember
very dangerous, not only to other people but to myself, because I knew I was either going to get killed or kill somebody or
I remember dangerous
drug addict,
right? But yeah. Even before that, like, I remember walking down like Avenue A with you back in like in 89 when it was dangerous. I don't know when it was, and I remember how people looked at you. And with like really rough looking dudes looked at you with reverence, and they were afraid of you. And I remember one time this guy, remember, he goes, "Hey, you got some money?" And I go, "Nah." And he goes, "Fuck you, man." And he came at me, and then he saw you. I was with you, and you pointed at him. You go, "Hey, motherfucker, don't fuck around with my friends." And he literally looked like he saw a ghost. And then you said, I'll get you when you're not on this block. You know that.
Yeah.
And he was so afraid of you. And that was the first time I went, oh, John's got a rep. I mean, he's got a real street
cred. Well, you know what it was?
Here.
I was never a bully, and I hated bullies because I was bullied on as a kid. So
right.
I always never was a bully. But at the same time, you didn't have to start trouble down in Alphabet City. Trouble would
found
find
you.
You. And then, you know, I mean, we've had people storm into our squat. You know, and not these summer squatters that you find here going to friggin' Western Union to get money from their moms and dads so they can write books later in life about how they squatted on the Lower East Side and did her and had a heroin habit. It's like, we lived this shit. And when motherfuckers came into your place with guns or whatever trying to take your shit, you had to fight people back. But I would say that the defining moment in my life, you know, was meeting in 1980, meeting the Bad Brains, and because they HR and that band just showed me another side to life, which was, you know, the music, the arts, and the spirituality. And that's
by the way, I mean, I don't know a lot about music, but I do know that you guys, as the Cro-Mags and the Bad Brains, and those bands were huge influences on a lot of the bands that we listen to today, like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, etc., right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at the Beastie Boys. They just got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they thanked the Bad Brains twice because, like, I mean, I was at both of the Beastie Boys' first shows in Max's Kansas City. They opened up for Bad Brains, and then Trudy Heller's Playroom, they opened up for Bad Brains. I mean, everybody looked up to those guys. So to me, I was like, first and foremost, the first time I ever saw them, they just blew me away, and I just wanted to know what these guys were into. And then it turns out their whole entourage was like, the sound man was a raw food yogi dude, and like just the whole crew was just like into some. And it was right at a time where I knew I was in the Navy because I went from lockup to the Navy, and then I was fucking up in the Navy, and you know, just crazy. I mean, the shit that I did in the Navy, fucking selling acid, just beating people down, just insanity. I honestly feel at that point, if the higher power, whatever you want to call it, didn't intervene and bring these people into my life, I probably wouldn't have survived because I just didn't have regard for my life, any life at all. And right at that time when I needed some guidance, those dudes came along, and then it just, you know, HR was the first one to put a mic in my hand and say, yo, you should get into the music and all that. So that really was, you know, and then, like I said, the late J.W. Lee, who was their sound man, was into, you know, Eastern philosophy, Gurdjieff, Ram Dass, Krishnamurti, yoga. And he started hipping me on the raw food stuff, you know, in like late 80, early 81.
Yeah, you were doing all that shit. You were doing all the shit.
Oh,
you,
yeah.
You were the muscular guy with tattoos way before anybody else.
Drinking fucking wheatgrass juice.
First time I met you, nobody was sleeved out in tattoos.
Yeah.
You had tattoos on your stomach, on your chest. Nobody had that shit,
bro. As a matter of fact,
bro.
I did a show in 81 at Irving Plaza. My first band, Blood Clot, that's how I got the name John Blood Clot. We opened up for Bad Brains. And
you also had to have an alias.
There's a tape of it, yeah.
You couldn't really give your real
John
name.
John Joseph is my middle name, and I was AWOL from the Navy for 15 years, so I couldn't.
And you ended up going to jail for that.
Yeah, well, I got turned in by my band member, Harley Flanagan, ratted me out.
Oh, no,
you know,
he
with
did?
His heroin, yeah.
What's he doing now?
Yeah, he's a loser, but, you know, whatever. I don't really talk about him that much, whatever. I wish him well, but. You know, the thing was, like, these dudes yelled out, tattoos are for jocks. Like, you know,
What do you mean, when?
Like, when I played that show in 81 and I was all tatted
tattoos
up.
Tattoos are
for
jocks?
This dude yells out, you hear it on the tape, tattoos are for jocks. I'm like, what?
That's weird.
But now everybody's all, most of the time I cover my shit up now because it's just like.
I remember that because you used to show up with your blonde hair and you dressed like a preppy.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I knew you were just the roughest dude. And people, you could never hide it though because my friends would be like, that dude's got a fucking look in his eye over there. Who is that tough guy?
Well, now you see these dudes and it's like they're tattooed on their fucking eyeballs and their necks. And I was reading one of these old, like, Hell's Angels type dudes who's, like, no fucking joke that I know was, like, it doesn't even mean anything anymore, like getting tattoos to these. It used to mean something, like when you had a tattoo on your fucking neck. It was like, you know.
Your badge.
Dude, yeah.
You've like, done some shit.
Now it's just
you've
like,
done some shit to earn
you
it.
You see these dudes with teardrops, which you're not supposed to get unless fucking you killed somebody. And like, you know, spider webs on the elbows, which also means that you killed somebody. It's like, dudes, just go.
Oh,
and
that was
get,
all. That was all like gang
initiation.
It was
all like biker gang shit. And I mean, me, like everybody I knew that had ink back in the set. I mean, I got my first tattoo in 1980. You know, I escaped from boot camp and went in the middle of the fucking night into fucking Chicago, and we came back and like the company commander knew that I went, and he's like, all right, let me see it, jerk off. You know, like, but it's, you know, now it's just like, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
know, I don't even.
But at least your tattoos always meant something.
Yeah, mine are based on Eastern philosophy, so it's like, you know,
well, that might have been why there was always such a uniformity. I remember women loved them, too. You'd be walking around with, like, a shirt off in the summertime, and these fucking preppy girls would just see you and be like, hey, baby, you look really good. They just lose their fucking mind, man. I remember my sister met you. My sister goes, she goes, I want to rip his clothes off. I was like, all right, well, you know, listen, he's a rough dude. But now here's my question to you. So we've defined when your spirituality happened, and you've been in New York your whole life. You've come up really truly on the streets and the School of Hard Knocks. You've made good. But New York has changed a crazy amount, man. I mean, it's beyond what
that's
I can imagine.
That's an understatement.
Like I remember just being with you in the Lower East Side and how fucking dangerous it was, man. Mm. I remember we were in Tompkins Square Park when it was a fucking squatter camp. That dude had a machete. Remember, he was like, we started kind of, you were saying something to him, and he pulled out a machete. He goes, he said, you know, I don't know what he fucking said to us, but a machete in the middle of Tompkins. Nobody fucking said anything about that guy.
Yeah.
I remember just being like, I was with you, Rich, Blue. We were with some rough fucking
guys.
Oh,
yeah, those guys.
But I was still like, if we get in a fight here, somebody's going to get knifed or shot.
Oh, dude, people would turn up dead on the regular in Tompkins Square Park. It was like, especially dudes that would come down here to cop drugs because they would get caught out there. And, you know, I had my one friend, Eddie the Cup Man, this Spanish
dude. I met him. I remember Eddie the Cup Man.
The motherfucker, the first time I seen him, he just had this dude between two cars, like stabbing him up. And just a crazy 5'5" Spanish dude that you did not want to fuck with.
No.
And the whole Lower East Side was filled with those types of I mean, I knew dudes that had multiple bodies under their belt, but they would like...
You introduced me to a couple.
Yeah.
I remember that one Puerto Rican dude we met who was like, I don't remember his name, but he was a rough-looking dude. He was really nice. He was really nice to you and everything. And you were like, that dude runs the biggest... You told me he ran this fucking huge gang.
Oh, you probably met my boy Eddie from the Hitmen. The big chunky dude.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew all those cats. I got in a fight with them because they came into 171 where Bad Brains rehearsed and recorded their album and started pulling knives and smacking people, and nobody would fight them. That's when I was still on drugs. I was on a Quaalude. Like, that's why they call it a gorilla biscuit, because you just get gorilla strong and somebody could punch you in the face.
They
and
call
just,
it a gorilla biscuit?
Yeah, that's what Quaaludes would call gorilla biscuits. Back in the day. And I was like, why don't anybody fight these fucking guys, man? Come on. And the owner of the studio was like, don't fuck with them. They run all the drugs down here. They'll fucking kill you. So I got in a fight with a bunch of them, five of them with a chain, and they all had knives trying to. I knocked the first dude out, and then they all came at me. I fought them with. I ended up getting stabbed. But in the end, they respected me because they were like, you're the only white motherfucker down here that got heart. None of those dudes would ever stand up. You know, I mean, that's just the way it was. You, in New York, you know, especially, you know, growing up on the streets and shit, it's like people tried to test you all the time. So, you know, it was very dangerous place. The Lower East Side was, I mean, when I started.
I remember it.
I was a heroin mule for these junkies. When I ran away from St. John's, because I looked like a little kid. I was 14. They would bring me down here, and I would cop all their bundles, 10 bags of heroin. So I would be holding, like, you know, 20 bundles of heroin for these dudes so that they didn't get tossed and arrested. So that was my first, you know, experience of coming down here in 77.
Jeez.
The shit was a war zone. Every fucking building was smashed up.
Oh, 77 was the craze. You could buy blocks, probably a whole block for 100 grand. Nobody wanted to live here.
I mean, even down here, you could, even in the early 80s, they had the tilt program. You could buy buildings for like a dollar. We were like, as long as you fixed it up, we were like, who the fuck wants to live down here? Now look at it.
Oh, now it's the most expensive real estate. And you can't get an apartment on Ludlow. Those apartments are going for $2,800 for a one bedroom, $3,500.
They got condos, $1.5 million on Avenue fucking D. You know the
Avenue D.
You know the expression we had?
Yeah, Avenue A is
if
your adventurous.
If you went to A, you was adventurous. B, you were bold. C, you were crazy. D, you were dead. And E, you were in the East fucking River. Like, dude, it shocks me. But you know what? I never left. And, you know, I just watched the evolution of this whole shit.
In a lot of ways, it's a good thing, but I mean, I just spent money at John Varvatos on the Bowery.
Old CBGBs.
That was CBGBs, man.
Yeah, man. I saw the
fucking clothing store.
I saw the Ramones play there. I mean, I was involved in the punk scene heavily because my first real girlfriend that I fell in love with, who died of a heroin overdose, she was a punk rock junkie. Took me to fucking CBs and Maxes and stick balls and all these. The Mud Club and everything. So it was like my first exposure to that whole shit was going, seeing the Ramones and the Dead Boys and all these bands down at CBGB's and going to Max's Kansas City, and that whole, my whole shit was punk rock. And now you go in there and it's like John Varvatos, you know.
John Varvatos. Now you go in there and it's $2,000 for a leather jacket. Whereas CBGB's was a place, well, I'd been there just a couple of times, and I think once to see you play in a couple songs. And I remember finding a corner, and I didn't want to go to the bathroom. I was afraid I'd catch tetanus. I mean, that place was where fucking...
Well, that,
you know,
that bathroom's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now, the fucking the toilet, because it was just fucking legendary. I mean, the whole shit of CB's, and the back alleyway was a shooting gallery. Fucking, you know, the Dead Boys would ask to get paid in hamburgers and heroin and go out back in that alleyway around the corner, and...
Jesus.
Motherfuckers would be getting mugged over there. You had all...
It was chaos.
If you read, I'll tell you a great book if you want to know what that whole shit was like. Patti Smith's book, Just Kids. When she describes what the Bowery was like, and, you know, the whole thing. I used to do these walking tours last year with tourists coming in. It was called The History of Punk Crime and Art on the Lower East Side. And I would take people around for these two-hour walks, and they would be like... You know, and I knew all the spots where, oh, yeah, this drug gang here, this is what had, this is where the dude chopped up his girlfriend and fed her to the homeless. I lived underneath.
I remember that.
I lived underneath that dude in that building.
I remember you did.
Yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
dude, what was his name? Ernie?
Daniel Rakowitz.
Yeah, Daniel Rakowitz. And did he chop his girlfriend up? The legend is he chopped his girlfriend up and had a soup, a
yeah,
barbecue.
Well, that's exactly what he did. He chopped her up for, well, see, what happened was the way that whole shit went down is a legendary story. My friend was, Crazy Dave was the crackhead super of the building, so he was letting all these people move into the apartments, and the building was in foreclosure. So he was just the super that was supposed to keep it clean, but nobody was living in there.
Yeah.
So he, being a crackhead, was like, I can get $200 a month to let this guy stay here. So he matched this dude, Daniel Rakowitz, let this girl, Monica, whatever, move into the apartment with him. And at first, he told everyone he was a reincarnation of Jesus Christ. He walked around with a fucking rooster on his shoulder. So she must have been like,
rooster.
Wow, this guy's really cool. And she was from Switzerland. And, oh, he's so interesting and different.
Oh,
but then when she
no.
finally saw, I mean, we all knew that the dude was out of his fucking mind. So she tried to break up with him. And he's like, you know, you don't break up with Jesus, bitch. And hit her over the head with a hammer, killed her, and then chopped her up. You know, in a tub, melted down her shit with acid and whatnot. But a lot of the organs and stuff, he made a fucking soup out of it and was feeding it to the homeless people in Tompkins Square Park. So he was feeding her to the homeless people.
That's a good way to get rid of evidence.
And the funniest shit was that Crazy Dave, I remember the day, we were like, he's like, yo, where is this chick? She owes me money. And then he starts finding all her shit in the garbage. he was throwing it away. So he said to him, like, hey, like, where's, you know, where's Monica? And he's like, I fucking killed her. I chopped her up and I fed it to the homeless. And Crazy Dave, he's Cuban. He was like, yo, man, that's not funny, bro. Come on. And then, like, he's like, dude, I'm telling you, that's what happened. And looked at him, like, straight the fuck on, like, the way I'm looking at you now. So Crazy Dave flipped out. He goes to the ninth precinct. He's like, mira, the fucking guy, he fucking, you know, he chopped up his girlfriend. All that shit is in the garbage, man. I believe him. The cops threw him out of the ninth precinct twice. The second time, they said, if you come back again, we're going to fucking lock you up. It wasn't until the dude, until her mother filed, came and filed the missing persons report, because she didn't hear from her daughter for like a month.
Jesus.
And then when they put two and two together, you know, that day that he got arrested, I was bike messenger and I come down, and there used to be a Gap on 2nd Avenue, the store, and he stopped me right in front of the Gap. He's like, hey, did you hear what happened? He's like, they're trying to say I murdered my girlfriend. I said, motherfucker, you admitted you did, and I know you did that shit by just looking at you. And like,
I remember you used to be so confrontational.
2 hours later, he fucked, because I just don't like evil motherfuckers, period.
I remember that one guy tried to shake your hand, and he had fucked you over. You go, I ain't shaking your hand, motherfucker. How about that guy who bit, we'll get to that in a bit, but I remember another guy tried to shake your hand who had bitten off a Hell's Angel's nose.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that guy, and he went to jail, and he come back, and he started trashing the bar in front of us, and I'm like ready to go. That guy was big and fucking strong, and you're like, man, you look like you were about to take a nap. You were like, fuck this guy, because you knew he wouldn't dare come at you.
Yeah, yeah.
His name was Bags, right?
Yeah. Well, he I don't know if it was a Hell's Angel, it was a biker's nose. And
he bit his nose
off. Yeah, the Civil Liberties Union came after him for like disfiguring. I mean, he was just a fucking maniac.
Again, like, another guy who you probably don't know, Eddie the Cut Man, Bags, all these guys. What happened to all these guys? Where are they?
Eddie the Cut Man is been in and out of fucking Bags. Disappeared to the West Coast. He was violation, probation. Eddie been in and out of jail. Now he's in this, like, you know, like work program, like where they give you a trade and all this shit and give you a place to. I mean, you know, if you don't get off the drugs and you fuck around, it's
you're done. Now go back to this guy who. So you said, I know you killed him, motherfucker. So
yeah.
What
so
happened
2 hours later, he went to the precinct and confessed and took them to Port Authority bus terminal where he had her bones in a bucket in a locker, and then like they locked them up. And the funny shit was, he said that he had killed a lot of people that had come down here to buy drugs. Like, he admitted that there was more than just one person that he killed.
Oh, shit.
So, dig this. So, the dude from the Village Voice is investigating this whole cult murder shit. And this is at the same time, you know, pressure point. They cleaned up the neighborhood. The fucking developers were coming in. So, you know, the last thing that they wanted after
was a serial
killer. You know, this whole thing of these cult murders. So the dude that was investigating it from the Village Voice ended up dead. Somebody gave him a hot shot of heroin, and he never did heroin in his life, and they found him dead with a needle sticking in his arm. So somebody put the kibosh on that whole story. You know, but it's just being down here all the years, and you know, you hear
it's
about...
It's such a colorful place. And New York is, in some ways, as great as all these changes have been, it is become an island for the rich. I mean,
oh, it's terrible. I mean, that's what I say. Giuliani took New York out of New York. I mean, there was just, I just watched this thing about 42nd Street, what we called, you know, what they call now Times Square, but to us, we called it the Deuce. And with all the seediness and the porno theaters and the pimps and the hustlers, I mean, the first time I ever really went up there, I went up there with this crazy fucking kid. I was in the home in St. John's, whose father set him on fire, his mom's boyfriend, rather, and he was burnt from the neck down, but just, he ended up doing time for killing two people. But we went up there, and, like, these dudes sold us beat acid, and then, like, oh, yeah, we came back complaining, and it was all these pimp-looking motherfuckers, and they're like, oh, nah, you got to run around the block to get it in your fucking bloodstream. So they had us doing loops around fucking 42nd Street, running around the block. They're all laughing at us. And then finally we're like, yo, the dude beat us. And when we went back, like, two of them pulled out guns on us, like, get the fuck off the Deuce, white boy. Like,
oh,
I mean, that's, you know, but that was part of New York and growing up here, I love what Alicia Keys said, because she was like, you know, she grew up in them projects right by 40.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, man. And she said in an interview, and I never forget it, she said it was so amazing because, like, you had the Deuce right there, and with all its seediness and just, you know, the worst of the worst, like, but still New York. That's what New York was about. And then she said she would walk 5 blocks, and then she would be in the theater district, completely different.
Yeah, man.
And well, that's what I said about New York. It was always like different universes, and if you didn't want to fuck with that universe, you just didn't go there.
You could literally walk 5 blocks and be safer than you would. Absolutely. You know, it's so funny how human beings are like that.
Well, that was
the
first
thing.
Don't
go to that area. That's a bad
area. That's what they said, that First Avenue was like going past. That's like being.
Yeah, First Avenue, you were safe.
That was the
Avenue demilitarized. Avenue B was. Yeah.
That was the demilitarized zone, you know, the DMZ. That, you know, if you went that way, you were. You know, especially Tompkins Square Park, man, you know.
I remember so well walking down to meet you and, you know, meet Blue or, like, Patty. And I would go, when I'd be on 2nd Avenue, I was and like, right, and at, like, Astor Place or whatever, I was like, all right, I'm fine.
And
then
you
first
would see
Avenue,
all the dudes selling
dude,
drugs
first,
right there.
And then Avenue A and then Avenue B. And I would never, I never went down to see. I was just like, fucking, I got to be. This
they
is
had
crazy.
The one after hours club. It was called the Sin Club back in the early 80s. And it was an acronym. It stood for Sin, Safety in Numbers. Because, like, you didn't come down there unless you had fucking 10 people with you. Like,
you
they
not.
Would roll up on you. Yeah. I mean, unless, like, they knew us. We had the, you know. Our crew was like the white boy crew that, you know.
You didn't fuck with.
And the other dudes that were down here that a lot of people didn't fuck with was the Teddy Boys, the real rough fucking hooligan English motherfuckers that had the balls to come down here and fucking fight, too. They were no joke. The Teddy Boys, Teddy Boys were no joke, you know, as far as like the other white dudes that were down here. But like we were in those fucking buildings and them squats and. You would see people getting murdered and fucking thrown off roofs and fucking shot. You'd hear gunshots fucking all night long, man.
It was always amazing to me. You looked at New York and you thought to yourself, there's absolutely no way they could ever clean this place up. You used to have these thoughts sometimes. You'd be like, man, I wish a strong rain would come and wash all the muck away. And even though New York has its character, it was also full of a lot of, it had a smell to it, like a bad smell, you know, in some ways. And what's interesting is how quickly it changed when money came in, because all that real estate became valuable. Mm. And so it was not, you could no longer afford to have the flavor, if you will. You know, and so what's happened now is it's become very white.
Oh,
you know, it's very become very Asian. It's become very international.
Well, you want to hear a good story? When Eddie got out of jail the last time, I seen him on the street, and he was like, I don't know, he did like 5 or 7 years or something. And even in that time when he came out, he was like, the shit changed. It was like a culture shock to this dude.
Yeah.
I mean, this motherfucker's still walking around with the fucking, remember those leather Puerto Rican flag medallions? Like with his fucking pimp shit, like still.
Yep.
And he's like, yo, man, what the fuck, bro? This fucking neighborhood. And then he's like, yo, these big motherfucking white boys last night, like 3 of them, they surrounded me and shit all drunk. He's like, ka-ka! You know, like he's flipping out a switchblade. He's like, yo, I had to pull on them niggas, man. I put that shit against that nigga's throat. I said, yo, nigga, have a nice time in my motherfucking neighborhood. And they were like, yo, chill out, chill out. Like, you know, everyone walks down here now. Like, they have no idea who's still
no
fucking
idea.
Down here.
Nah.
Like, with some of these cats that they just look at some dude. And they don't realize that dude has killed a lot of people.
He's killed a lot of
people. And
he
doesn't give a fuck. And if you fuck with him.
He'll just go back to
And there's so many of them down here still that I'll occasionally see them walking around and. Now it's like, the funny shit is, and I always say, like, yo, man, we didn't even used to say hello to each other. Now, because we recognize each other, we're like, yo, dog, how you been, man?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like.
I think we're good.
We'll sit.
My box that fell. All right.
Is that right?
Yeah, we're good.
I mean, we'll sit there and actually talk and be like, and I still see some of these motherfuckers around, like these dudes who ran the whole heroin shit. There used to be this dude on 7th between. B and C, you know, he went to he did Rico. He was one of the first dudes to go down under the Rico stature. This
really?
Dude, Junior, but
Rico
he was,
is the racketeering act for those.
Yeah,
of you guys
they
don't
got
know.
Him, and they got a couple.
The Rico
of his,
act actually took down most organized crime.
Yeah, they got him, and they got a lot of his.
And the Rico act, just his, so you guys know, is if you are a head of a criminal organization, and as the head of that criminal organization, if you. Even if your underlings do a crime, you are responsible.
Yeah.
They can put you in jail.
Well, you know, the thing was, like, none of his street lieutenants, which I knew a lot of them, like, bad fucking dudes, none of them would rat. But they got him. They had wiretaps on him, and they were surveilling the whole thing. I mean, and the guy was a martial arts instructor. Like, a lot of these dudes, and I won't mention a lot of their names, but some of these dudes are very famous in the world of martial arts. They were all down here running criminal enterprises, fucking selling fucking drugs, and, like, you just didn't
Wasn't
fuck
that the
with
same
these
thing
cats.
With a lot of rap guys? Like I don't want to, you know, I mean, a lot of the, they always say the guys that make the most money are the guys who ran drug, who, you know, because they had no other option, and they were.
Well, Jay-Z admits
well, Jay-Z,
it, you know,
yeah,
Jay-Z
learned
all
how to be a
DMX,
businessman.
All
yeah.
these motherfuckers, like, ran drug spots. Like, the shit that they sang about, like, when I go to Europe and I hear motherfuckers talking about the streets, I'm like, motherfucker, you don't know about the streets. Give me a break. What do you fucking know in Dusseldorf, Germany, motherfucker? What streets you got?
Well, I mean, you really did. I mean, New York City, you know, and when you came up in the 70s and the 80s, was truly a dangerous place and was a legendary place. I mean, when you talked about New York and you everybody who lived in New York, everybody had a story, at least one story about being mugged. Now, New York City has one of the lowest crime rates in the world. That, to me, almost sounds impossible because I'd been around and had seen New York. My mother was born and raised in Brooklyn. You grow up hearing the stories, reading the newspapers, being in New York, and it really is a different, it is just truly a different world. It's just a different, and technology is changing everything at such an exponential rate. I always talk about this, that in 10, 20 years, it seems that, first of all, you can't get away with anything. The other thing is when you get in a fight on the street or you get in a fight, you know, you do anything, you got cameras everywhere now, fucking everywhere.
Right.
You're
and
being
you know
watched
what? Like,
everywhere you go.
You know what? I mean, I understand about the whole Big Brother shit and whatever, but at the same time, them shits is catching a lot of motherfuckers that's doing shit like beating up old people.
Right.
Like this
it's a good thing in a lot of ways.
Piece of shit motherfucker that just like stomped this old man's face into the ground. They caught that motherfucker because the business had cameras outside of. So to me, I'm not committing crime. So I don't give a fuck if there's a fucking camera. I'm not breaking the fucking law. It's the ones breaking the fucking law that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and whatever. This whole.
It has made the world
the
safer.
Civil liberties, you know, this, that, the other thing. I'm like, I understand because I'm all informed about, you know, Big Brother and what and a lot of major motherfucking issues of what's really going down globally. But at the same time, on a community level, my mother could walk down the street now and not have to worry really about, you know, getting mugged or whatever.
Right.
And, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of that is a deterrent. And you know, here's the other thing. I grew up in New York. I know, like, the New York City cops are getting a bad rap because of a few that did whatever. But the cops that they brought in during those Occupy Wall Street and all that shit, them motherfuckers didn't come from the city. Those dudes grew up on Long Island. They have no clue. I know so many cops in the 9th Precinct that are just the coolest fucking dudes ever. One of them comes to our shows. He got a fucking mohawk. He sleeve tattoos on his fucking neck and everything. It's like, you can't. Just because there's a couple of bad cops that's doing shit now in New York City, especially like this lady just got shot.
I know, but it's not even close to what it used to be.
Yeah, it isn't. You know, and, you know.
It's a professional force. I mean, it's a professional force. Know, it's not that the corruption that used to be there isn't even there.
I mean, dude, the 9th Precinct was one of the dirtiest precincts in the
right.
whole fucking city. That's how they got away with doing with all the drugs in this whole neighborhood. You know, but at the same...
Well, they made a movie about it, Serpico. I mean,
yeah, well, that was...
Al Pacino.
That was Uptown Precinct. But the Ninth Precinct, if just a bit of trivia, that's where they shot Barney Miller, was filmed in there. I mean, it had a rep for being, like, a dirty fucking precinct with, you know, back in the 70s with cops on the take or whatever. But, you know, I look at it this way. You know, I'm glad that I was around in New York to see all this stuff, but would I want to go through all that shit now at this point in my life? No, because honestly, like, I would have a lot less patience to have, like, when I walk around now and, like, dudes try to hard rock you on the street, I just basically laugh at that shit and walk away.
Because you were the original hard rock.
I'm like, dude, you know.
I can't imagine somebody fucking with you, you know, in that sense, because it's true. I mean, and by the way, when you get older, you don't have the time for that shit.
Yeah,
I just
want
to breathe,
dude,
the air and drink a coffee.
I'm getting ready to go home and work on my book, or, you know, I'm going to ride my bike, whatever the fuck. I'm just so busy with everything. I don't have time for...
You haven't had a drink or done any drugs in how many years?
Nah, a long time, man.
20 years?
More than that, yeah. Like, I mean...
25.
Even before I had my little... crack breakdown in 88 for like 6 months or whatever, but I was clean before that, and then
you've never been a drug alcohol guy. I mean,
I mean, when I was younger,
I've known you for over 20 years.
Like I said, when I met the Bad Brains, that really flipped the script on me, because like those dudes were into some real metaphysical shit, and I was like, it just came along in my life, and I was like, yo, you know. Definitely, this is what I was looking for. And again, like I said, it wasn't religion and dogma. It was really just my eyes opening. I started reading all this Eastern philosophy and living. I lived as a monk for like 3 years.
Now you were a monk for 3 years, and I just have to talk about this, because one of the things about being you lived as a monk, but one of the things about the aesthetic lifestyle, sort of deciding to restrict your appetites and restrict yourself, is that as you get older, you start to realize that in a lot of ways, that really is the way. Like, you meet a lot of people. I know a lot of people with a lot of money. And what's interesting is it never really closes the holes that you have in your personality or your spirit. And it's so funny, because you have one side of the spectrum when you're talking about drugs and stuff. And you've seen how ugly drugs are. You've seen how just ugly they are. You know, you and I listened to a phone call recently by some crazy fan of mine who got my number somehow and called me, and she, I don't want to mention her name, but she literally was just rambling and being crazy and talking about how she didn't mean
gibberish.
Yeah, gibberish. And I was like, "What is that?" And you go, "She's been up for days doing
on drugs
or something." Yeah. And it's such an ugly thing. And it really does seem like, as I get older, anyway, like you know, you can have a big house, which, as my friend Joe Rogan said, just means that your dogs and the people you love are a little farther away from you, and you got more to clean. You know, you can have status, you can have reputation, you can have all those things. And I've seen it. I've had it. We've all had it to an extent. And at the end of the day, something's sort of always missing, you know. And I do think human beings are always kind of moving toward pleasure and away from pain. But it seems that the best way to go about it in a lot of ways is to go through pain in the short term, kind of get used to restricting your appetites, used to having command over yourself, all your urges. And it's just interesting, man. It's just interesting to hear.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things I always said was, the only thing wealth guarantees in this world now is you can buy the best prescription drugs out there to treat your depression. Because... it doesn't, you know, doing drugs and stuff doesn't really fill the void that's in your life. And that's something, you know, from what I went through as a kid, even after I left.
But, you know, by the way, drugs can be a lot of things. Drugs can be sex.
Yeah.
Drugs can be food.
Addictions. Yeah. People are addicted to different things.
But we're kind of hardwired. I talked to a psychiatrist about this. We're hardwired for addiction as human beings in some ways, because we operate on a pleasure-pain principle. We're always trying to get away from pain and toward pleasure. And a lot of times when we link a sensation up with that pleasure that keeps us away from pain, that sensation can be cocaine. And it links into the survival mechanism, the lizard part of your brain, that sort of mid part of your brain that says, I need this, and even if it brings me close to death, this is what's ultimately keeping you alive. It's an irrational kind of thing.
Well, that's what the Vedic literatures and all the yogic sciences from India say, the same thing. The nature of the soul is to enjoy, and if you don't do that spiritually, then you're going to look for some material gratification, whether it be drugs, whatever. I mean, I always say the happiest times, the most content time in my entire life was when I was a monk in Hawaii getting up at 2 a.m. I mean, you know, meditating, chanting, training in martial arts, you know, running, just living the life. And, you know,
I'd be fine with that as long as I can have my cappuccino and just really soft, plump companion. Well, John, I know you're busy. I don't want to take your time, and I like to keep these podcasts short, but you're one of the most colorful and interesting people I've ever met and one of my best friends. So
thank you, man.
Thanks for coming.
Go on. Same hair, Mr. Callan.
That's it. Same hair?
What do you mean? No, I said same hair.
I thought you were talking about my fucking hair on the podcast.
Nah.
Hey, anyway, this is the Brian Callen Show, otherwise known as the Brian Callen Podcast.
This is John Bloodclot Joseph.
John Bloodclot Joseph.
I Rastafari.
Signing off, everyone. I hope you learned nothing, because I have nothing to say or teach, but we like to have fun and talk. Thanks for tuning in. And Johnny.
Irie-ite.